Hello and welcome to the Lib Dem podcast. My name is John Potter. I am the host of this podcast as well as the leader of the Preston Liberal Democrats. Joining me is my fellow founder of the Lib Dem podcast, Richard Kemp from Liverpool. Hi. And we are absolutely delighted to be joined from Massachusetts, beg your pardon, by Professor Ethan Hirsch, who has written this book, which I have absolutely enjoyed reading and is all about political hobbyists and how the difference between whether you treat politics as a hobby or actually want to make real and lasting change. So thank you so much for coming on, Professor Hirsch. We really appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I suppose the place to start is, what is political hobbyism?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there's two phrases in the title of his book that anger people. The first is political hobbyism, and the second is political power. So hobbyism is basically doing politics to fulfill intellectual interests or emotional needs, usually fulfilling some kind of short-term gratification, you know, learning new facts, feeling political feelings. There's no active participation that's goal oriented. So I like seeing it, that defining it in relation to political power, which is, you know, working with other people with some goals and strategies to influence the government. That's really what we do when we're doing politics. But as a political scientist, I kind of came to the conclusion that if you look at how ordinary people are engaging in the political process, it doesn't look like power seeking. It doesn't look like trying to have any goal or have a strategy to fulfill a goal. It just looks like something done for yourself, similar to how you might, you know, engage in sports fandom or being a foodie or anything like that. It seems more in that category of life than in the category of trying to move people in your direction.
And me and Richard have had this conversation several times on this podcast about, you know, people that just get angry watching political panel shows instead of and shouting at the TV instead of going out and doing it. And it's something we've talked about a lot, isn't it, Richard, about people need to make that step in, and even at a very local level, to start actually getting active.
Yeah, I mean, my definition is more them that do and them that talk, frankly. I never watch political programs on the telly. It just raises the blood pressure too high. I just rather go out and do things, whether that's at a national level, where I lead at the moment for local government in Liberal Dems in local government on health, or actually what I've been doing this morning, just going out meeting people in the area that I represent to try and get some specific actions going to help perhaps 20 people's lives. But I'm a doer, not a talker. And I think that's the sort of the way that I describe it. Now, some of those doers want to talk policy and go and lobby the government. Some of those doers want to do it in the street they live in.
And I think, Professor Hirsch, you make the distinction of what you call amateurs versus regulars. Now, that comes back, is it from the 50s America?
And the 50s.
Kind of shift that happened?
Well, there was, you know, for a long time, particularly in our cities, there were these party machines that ran the show. They not only held offices, but through a party apparatus, they extended benefits to people. You know, they would give you $20 if you couldn't pay your electric bill. They would have a lot of patronage jobs. And for the most part, that's done away with. But there in the 50s was this fight where those people were trying to retain power. They didn't really care about policy. You know, if you have a rough sense of American history, you probably know that the Democrats were a fairly conservative party. The Southern white racial conservatives were part of the Democratic Party. In the cities, the Democratic Party wasn't particularly liberal on all sorts of issues, but there emerged this class of people, highly educated white liberals, in the post-war era, that came back and they said, you know, the machines are doing this dirty form of politics. They're trying to retain power not by offering good policy, but by like being a neighborly ward boss, and we got to do away with that. And they really did do away with that. But there is you know, I think there's a part of the book that basically suggests that they did away with a lot of important parts of what it takes to get things done, in addition to some of the corruption and racism that went along with the party machines.
I think our response to that was to invent something as a party in the first instance, and we do it better and more than anyone else. We invented something called community politics, which says, yes, we want to be the prime minister, we want to take control of government locally or centrally, but you do that street by street, neighbourhood by neighbourhood, community by community, because that actually fits with our political belief. Because if there's one thing we want to do as Liberal Democrats is to take power from Westminster, the Whitehall machinery, and bring it down to the regions, the states in your area, to bring it down to the cities and the boroughs and the neighbourhoods. So what we wanted to do as campaigners in this context coincided with what we wanted to do as political animals. And that makes us quite different still in this country than our opponents, because although we want power, we only want it to deliver the principles that we have, because otherwise it would be easier for us to join another party, because it's not easy being the third party anywhere in the world. So principles first, power second would possibly make us not absolutely distinct from the other parties, but quite distinct.
And I think in the book you talk about sometimes the right wing kind of lobbies in America, whether that's the gun lobby or and things like that, or the Tea Party when they came around, kind of understood that kind of we need to do this at a grassroots level and work that kind of community structure, because no campaign wins without that structure underneath it. And it's something that because liberal-minded people, like I say, love talking about policy, that they don't think about those important local structures. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few things going on, right? So I think for a lot of people think that, you know, if you're a political junkie, the way that you're going to move someone in your direction is by either lamenting what you hate about the other party, going and saying, oh, did you hear this thing I heard on cable news about how the other party is really stupid and evil? Or they're going to do this policy thing, which is like, you know, here's the 10 important points for the, you know, Democratic Party's healthcare system. And for a lot of people, that is just not what's going to motivate them to vote. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the structures, it's not really a left or right thing, although I think the right has in some ways done it better. You know, I use the example, like you said, of the gun lobby, which has a local infrastructure of gun clubs that offer actual goods and services to people, like free safety classes for children. And that brings people together. I mean, if you think about what churches do, you know, every religious institution that I know that has children in its building offers free babysitting, at least during their services. It's not a big shocker why they do that. They want people there, and that's what people want. And, you know, whether you're coming to pray to God or to have an hour break from your children, you're still in the building. And there's examples of this across the board. I talk at the introduction of the book about the Ku Klux Klan offering opioid addicts assistance in North Carolina in 2018. I talk about some of the groups like Hezbollah or the Muslim Brotherhood that have education and healthcare systems. And on the left in America, you see this too, history of black power groups providing free breakfast and lunch and health services and all sorts of things. And those groups do that because they know the way to people's hearts is not just to talk about national policy, but it's to meet them where they are, empathize with their needs, and offer them stuff. And you know, what's interesting is I think there still is this very, very broad class of again, these hobbyists or kind of these, you know, well-educated elites who think like, you know, I'd rather not have people on my side if I have to offer them free breakfast. It's just amazing. You know, I get into this kind of fight with the attorneys in my state of Massachusetts who regulate political finance, and I walked them through this. I said, you know, could a local political party, could they offer, you know, could they use the party funds to offer food assistance? Could they have lunch that opens up lunch to the people who are going hungry? And they said, I don't know. That feels like a social service. That's really not something a party should be doing. And I said, you got to be kidding me. These parties are allowed to have like a weekly pancake breakfast for themselves, but they can't offer food to people who are hungry. Like, it's insane. But that, you know, I think that's what you get when you get this politics that's trying to be like perfectly clean and not focused on meeting people's needs.
And it's interesting.
Go on, Richard. No, go on, Richard.
I mean, that, if we just go back to the food example, it would be one that was totally alien to the way that we do business here as politicians. I think it might even be illegal for us to offer food to people.
Yeah, here too.
That would be considered as an inducement. So I now represent one of the wealthiest parts of Liverpool. I used to represent one of the poorest parts of the country. And my response to food poverty was to set up food banks of local people who are independent and then try and find the money to support them so that they took the decisions, not me. And some other parties would do it that way. Some parties, of course, wouldn't give a damn about any of that. But it wouldn't occur to me to in any way have a whip round, as we would call it here, to buy food for people from behalf of the Liberal Democrats. And also, the other thing that intrigues me as an onlooker into politics is the role of religion in all this. Because I can honestly say, with all our members in Liverpool, I haven't got a clue who's a member of what religion. And although they will express an opinion on moral things like poverty, the churches very much do not get involved in politics.
I think that's a huge difference between the US and the UK, though. Even though we have an established church in the UK, it is of nowhere near the power of the churches within the US, even though there's supposed to be separation of church and state, which is...
Well, don't forget, our churches are very decentralized. We don't have a church. We have a billion different churches. And most of the politics that happens in a church is not a pastor giving a sermon saying, you know, here's how you should vote. It's people who are in a tight social network who rely on each other for advice. I mean, this is the thing that I think, you know, and we have this big left-right divide in America now on this, where essentially, again, this class, well-educated white liberals, Democrats, they identify as spiritual but not religious. They are not part of church networks. Minorities within the Democratic Party and the Republican Party are much more active in church. Now, if you're I'm active in my religious community here. Every year when there's an election for local office, about which my well-educated friends know almost nothing, and I send them an email and say, hey, just so you know, here's the people I'm voting for. And let me know if you have any questions. And I know, like, probably 50 people walk into their polling place with my slate. And they do that not because they're religious automatons. It has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with the fact that we are in a community of mutual respect, and we have some sense in which we defer to others for good judgment. And I think that that's what happens in religious communities all over the place. And I think when you have, as we do in the United States, this big party divide with religion, you have to worry, if you're on the Democratic side, that you're not able to leverage those social connections in the same way that the other party is able to.
Mm. And I'm really interested because you talk about hobbyism, and some people might go, you know, so what's wrong with it? What's wrong with having just being interested in politics and not actually doing anything about it? Surely me arguing on Twitter must have some effect. But in the book, you go on to say some of the problems that hobbyism can actually cause to your cause, actually, to what you're trying to do. And one of them you talk about is being a provocateur, a hobbyist provocateur in your book. So would you like to explain how sometimes hobbyism can actually make the situation worse for what you're trying to campaign for?
Yeah, I think, I mean, a lot of people have this intuition. In fact, I have this intuition too. Like, maybe, isn't it possible? It would make me feel a lot better anyway if the 2 hours I spend on Twitter is somehow going to be like a gateway drug into real participation in politics. And the problem with that, there are several, but mainly you're learning the wrong information and practicing the wrong skills, right? So you can go to a news junkie here, and I'm sure it's the same case there, someone who spends 2 hours a day on politics. And then you ask this news junkie, tell me, how do I get involved on issues of the environment in my state? and they blush and they say, I don't know a damn thing about how to get involved about that. Mm-hmm. So, okay, well, tell me, who should I vote for the state offices? I don't know anything about that. I can tell you about the Trump impeachment trial. Is that useful to you? Oh, no, it's not. Okay, so you're learning the wrong information. And you're really, I mean, the provocateur problem is that you're practicing the wrong skills. So, you know, if we think about power relationships, whether like, a boss to an employee, or in my present condition, a parent to a child, you're always trying to get people to do things they wouldn't otherwise do. And in politics, we have this. You're trying to get your neighbor to vote a certain way. You're trying to get a politician to act a certain way. And in any kind of power dynamic, unless you're using violence, a coercion, you need to empathize with that person, figure out what's going to move them, meet them where they are, take them seriously, listen to them. That's true in parenting, in an employment situation, and it's true in politics too. And in politics, it's so clearly online, that is not the goal of our activities. We're not trying to move anyone anywhere. We're trying to feel some cathartic release ourselves. And so it's just like a totally different skill set. And in fact, you know, I often feel like I need to do detox when I talk to groups who are, you know, frustrated that, they had a protest and, you know, things didn't magically change in the direction that they hoped for. And, you know, welcome to like trying to run a state. Like, it's going to take a lot of time.
And liberals in Britain are going through this exact point now, because there were, in regards to Brexit, for the Liberal Democrats, we were very vocal, very critical. Say our banner in the 2019 general election was "Stop Brexit." We want, and whereas it got us lots of new members, it actually brought in donations, which again you talk about in your book how being kind of sensationalism might get you some more donations. But ultimately, we had a very poor 2019 election because we didn't take people on that journey with us, and we got the emotional high of yes, a big protest, but there was no kind of me and Richard have both got these kind of local groups that say, you know, we want to remain in Europe, we still want to be, you know, Preston for Europe, Liverpool for Europe, that sort of things, but there was no goal at the end of it. You know, they didn't go out and do canvassing teams to go out and win votes at that general election in any sort of great numbers.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and I think this does bring up that third point, which is worth emphasizing, which is that when we do politics, say, this way, we incentivize the politicians to do things that are against their own interests and against our interests. We make it worse for them. So right now in the United States, you can see that anytime there's a debate among, say, primary candidates, or anytime there's a hearing in the Senate or the House of Representatives, all of the politicians are just constantly trying to make viral videos of themselves so that they can get low dollar donations. Because it's very, very clear that the thing that drives low dollar donations is being as provocative and as obscene as possible. I mean, this is why Democrats everywhere, I talk to groups every week and I always ask, who's the best low dollar fundraiser in America? And everyone says Bernie Sanders. It's like, no, it's Donald Trump. He's much better. He raised more money in small dollar donations than Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders combined in 2016, because he is great at that outrage. So I'll just a quick story. A couple years ago, this the UK is involved in this story. There was a scandal here in the United States with Cambridge Analytica and Facebook, might know is kind of a scandal there as well. Yeah. And I had written a previous book on data analytics and campaigns, and I was asked to testify in the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is a kind of a high profile committee in the United States Senate, alongside the whistleblower from Cambridge Analytica. And I said I didn't want to do it because these things are just these like circuses. And the attorneys from the committee said, you know what, it is a circus, but it's good if you could put up with it. You know, you're going to write like this 10-page report and the lawyers are going to take your idea seriously. So, you know, all the behind the scenes stuff is important. So just, can you please put up with the circus? And I think like the fact that they, you know, that was their opinion, that basically like, yeah, of course, our hearings are just a complete like nonsense circus. But what I want to emphasize is like, that's our fault collectively, the group of citizens that are willing to give a $5 donation anytime a senator screams at another senator. Like, that's not them, like that's us.
I'm not altogether sure. John might disagree with me on this, that particularly applies here. I think one of the reasons being that, with the exception of some fairly wealthy Tories who take money from anywhere in sight, politics isn't a money game here in the same way that it appears to be as an outsider. Almost all the money that I spend as a Liberal Democrat in Liverpool is raised from our members who give regular donations. It doesn't occur to me, if I go on Twitter, to do something to get money from it. And I don't think it does to any of the other parties, certainly in my city. We might do it to influence people. But I mean, I use Twitter principally as a way of getting quick feedback if I'm thinking of something. So yes, John and I both have Twitter accounts, but we use them to say, this is what we've said, this is what we're doing. And we also have much less confrontation than seems to be part of your system.
No, I wouldn't agree with that. If you look at Twitter in the UK now, particularly since the Brexit referendum and the polarisation, that, and again,
yeah, it, but it, that's only people on Twitter, John. That's the point, isn't it?
Twitter isn't the real world, I think. But I want to kind of get back to some, again, in your book about some of the failings of, if you are hobbyist, and one of them is that the energy and the enthusiasm can be very short lived. And you talk about the Obama election. You know, when he got elected, there was a wave of enthusiasm, you know, yes, we can, and anything else. But that enthusiasm stalled. And then he lost the House. I don't know if it was a year later or 2 years later. And so all the power he had been able to get going was suddenly taken away because, you know, supporters and canvassers all just lost interest after winning that first little push to get him into power.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, you know, an unbelievable story. Now I'm getting to the point in age where my students now, you know, were 6 years old during the 2008 election. And it's like, you know, but for those who remember the 2008 election here, you know, it was at the tail of this market crash, a war, all sorts of things that made the Republican Party very unpopular. And the Democrats swept in and there was this huge amount of energy on the left. I mean, something like 1 million people donated to the Obama campaign. You could see I was in graduate school in Cambridge, Massachusetts at the time. And, you know, busloads of people were going up to New Hampshire, which is a swing state, to knock on doors. People were circulating these viral, kind of the first verse generation of YouTube viral videos of, you know, celebrities singing songs. And presumably they wanted to see some Democratic proposals become law. But the second the election was over, the Democrats just sat at home. You know, the next election for Congress, which was in 2010, turnout among Democrats, among young Democrats, just declines massively. Democrats lose control of the House of Representatives. The Democrats can't be bothered to show up to these town hall meetings where Republican Tea Party groups were organizing against the health care law that we were working on. And so, you know, it makes you think, like, well, are people motivated here by any kind of policy goal, or they just were into the celebrity of Barack Obama? And I think what's, you know, it's true with everything. You know, now we're obviously facing this this newfound interest in police reform, Black Lives Matter, and, you know, it's one thing to attend a protest. You know, I think protests raise awareness, and that's, you know, that's great. But then the next 10 things that happen are like your own community making decisions about, you know, little things like, when a police officer is accused of malpractice, is it another police officer or an independent person who evaluates that claim? And who's in charge of making that decision? And what committee is it? And, you know, it's a pain in the butt. But the thing is that there is only energy for these high moments and not for carrying on. So, you know, you have this situation. Obviously, not everyone in the world and not everyone in America is expected to be a real political activist in the trenches of politics. But we're in this situation where like a third of the country is spending hours a day on politics, and basically none of them are doing anything. So, you know, of the people who said they were afraid of Donald Trump, maybe 2.5% or something like that did any action in 2016. We have people who are the daily news followers, the most interested in politics. They belong to zero organizations, most of them. They've done zero things in the last year to work on a community issue. It's not like, you know, these are the people who think of themselves as civically engaged. And this book is about them. This book is not trying to chastise, you know, people who are working two jobs to you know, go and, you know, attend your local community meeting, if that's what you need to do. It's chastising the people that have plenty of time for this and to spend it in the least effective ways.
But isn't that actually quite a common sense and rational position for most people to take? If, for example, someone wants to be a candidate and become a councillor for my party in Liverpool, we will adopt people for next year's elections in September this year. My first thing I say goodbye to your husband or your wife or your kids, because you ain't going to see them again till the elections are over. And then we're going to throw you straight into being a councillor, looking after 15,000 people, and you won't see much of them for the next 4 years either. So isn't it rational that people will want to vent, but they don't want to be in the trenches because they do have a life to get on with?
I think what's irrational is, if you think about how politics has become very nationalized here, where even though local and state governments have a tremendous amount of control in the United States, people's attention is only focused on national politics. So right now, if you go ask Democrats in this country, what are the issues that are most important to you? They will predominantly say two issues. You'll say climate change, and they'll say racial equality. And if you think about those two issues, there are a million local things that affect both those issues, from regional transit systems to education to police forces. But these people don't even vote in a local election and don't even know who to vote for or how those issues affect their lives. So I think if you just take them seriously, that those are their issues, the idea that what they're really looking for is like, to see senators and Supreme Court justices and presidents fight about these things. And, you know, these are like people in Massachusetts, you know, for those who know, this is a very Democratic area. I mean, the Massachusetts senators, Elizabeth Warren, Ed Markey, they're never going to convince the senators from Mississippi and Alabama to go along with them. Never, yeah. Never. And so they either have to ram something through the federal government in some tiny moment where they have control, or... And that's really their only attention span. That's the only thing they have attention for. Or they're going to actually make some hard decisions locally. And the problem when they do these hard decisions locally, particularly this is a problem of the left, is that they find some cognitive dissonance. They actually don't want to raise this and that tax to pay for the environmental regulations. They actually don't want to fight with their neighbors about building high density apartment dwellings. You know, if all of these issues that come to the fray. So I don't think it's strictly rational to operate on this. But when what I'm asking for at a bare minimum, I'm saying the bare minimum, if you're a news follower, make sure you can vote in every election and know who those candidates are. And like something like 90% of Americans aren't meeting that bar.
Yeah. And it goes, how many people do vote in national and local elections on average in America?
So in a presidential election, we have about 60% of eligible people voting. In a midterm election, so our, you know, the other, you know, every the other even numbered years, just for Congress and Senate, it's something like 45-50%. For local elections, for, you know, mayoral elections and things like at that level, it can be 10-15% of the eligible population is voting.
So that's, I mean, from a kind of a British point of view, again, for the general election, that you generally get about 63-65% turnout. And from a council election, so whether that's a county, a big city election like Liverpool that Richard takes in, or the local boroughs, I think on average, I think it's about 30% we get in the UK. I mean, it depends on the ward. So my ward has, again, as a fairly affluent older generation, so that can go up to say 45%. But some of the wards in inner Preston, it will go down to low as 20. But I suppose the next kind of stage of this conversation and into your book is what we can do what successes can we change and what are good structures we can talk about. One of the ones you talk about is deep canvassing. Now me and Richard are pretty old war horses at campaigning, but I have seen some really poor canvassing in my time where people just go, "Hi, I'm such and such. Are you going to vote for me?" There's no engagement. There's no listening. And I think that your examples in your book say listening and wanting to engage with voters is actually key.
Yeah, you know, I think that most people here too, if they are motivated to volunteer because they feel like they just need to take that next step and they want to make phone calls or they want to canvass voters. You know, here in Massachusetts, we're just about an hour from the border of New Hampshire, which is again the closest swing state we have. People will go up and canvass, and it's usually a terrible experience for everybody. It's a terrible experience for the voter because you're bothering them at their door, and you're like a robot saying this speech that they've heard from other canvassers too. And if you're a canvasser, it's kind of a demeaning experience where you're also treated like an automaton who's supposed to say this two sentences and then write down this person as a 1 to 5 on a scale of how supportive they are of this or that party or how likely they are to vote. And you know, decampusing. So in the book, I talk like through 7 stories of organizers who are each doing a different thing, but all of them have this in common, which is that they see their job as sort of ordinary citizen volunteers as increasing the power of their vote. You know, they have one vote they're entitled to, how many more they can get. You know, there's stories of someone who kind of controls 1,000 votes. And there's people who like try to, their job, if you spend a day of canvassing and you talk to 2 people and have a shallow conversation, you might think, you know, or maybe talk to 10 people and have a shallow conversation with each one, you might think this is a waste of a day. I spent a whole day, I drove an hour, I knocked on doors, my feet hurt, and what have I done? I think all the organizers, they flip it and they say like, okay, I have an opportunity today to like double my voting power. If I can have one conversation that is going to change the direction of this voter, you know, it's some ways like how I view teaching, right? You know, you're facing an audience of 50 or 100 students, and some of them are, you know, falling asleep, and, you know, but you know, you have an opportunity to change lives, you know, and you really have to take that seriously. And I think that's what a lot of these canvassers do. So in deep canvassing, what you're trying to do is replicate a real relationship where you tell a story about yourself, a very, very personal story, and basically explain through that story how you've come to some conclusion about politics. And then you invite the other person, and this is the key part. You spend most of the time just listening to someone else's story, but you do it in a disarming way where you're not trying to judge someone for their views. You're not trying to have an argument. You're trying to say like, hey, this is where I come from on this particular issue. Where do you come from? And the big important lesson in that is that a lot of people who have views that you might think are awful or evil actually haven't thought through politics very much.
Yeah.
And so when you have this conversation where you say, this means a lot to me and here's why, and you say it to them, why does this mean so much to you? A lot of them actually think to themselves, ah, crap, this actually doesn't mean that much to me. And since it means so much to you and you're extending kindness to me, maybe I should, you know, take your opinion seriously.
But isn't the most effective time to get an opinion from people when there's no election on? So John and I are really frustrated at the moment about many things, but one of them is that we can't go door knocking because of the coronavirus. So we have about, in my electoral area, 6,000 houses. And the 3 councillors will try and call on each of those houses outside an election every year.
Yeah.
And that's when we pick up, what do we need to do in the community? Which people in the community do we bring in? That's when we've got time to have those non-political, political conversations. Yeah. When we find out what people really think. And you're right, most people are swayed by headlines. When you talk to them, one-to-one, face-to-face, on their doorstep, on the street, they're very different people. So why do political parties anywhere do all their campaigning during election time?
Yeah, it's a good question. And there is, I think, an opportunity, you know, what there's, it's generally considered a kind of a problem in American politics that we have so many elections. You know, there's, mm-hmm. there's, you know, I think a lot of, I don't know what on average, but probably on average, most voters are facing a couple elections every year. You know, for local offices, and sometimes you're in these like geographic units that are not even overlapping. You're in this county, but this city, and you know, and you have elections for everything, and it's really not very well coordinated. And that's not coordinated because our political parties are very, very weak at the local level, so they don't do very much. And the only time they have any they have any volunteer interest is really around those national elections. So I think that's the answer for why they only interact. Because they only do anything, they only can get those hobbyists motivated to knock on doors for 2 weeks out of the out of every 4 years. But in the communities that actually take their role as they're going to be regulars in the community, they're going to come before you at every election, whether it's local or national. If there's a new volunteer in the neighborhood, they're going to just go around and introduce themselves. That's what I think exactly right, where you can meet people and understand what they care about. And then when there is an election, it's not like you're, you know, you have some rapport with them so that you can actually talk to them in a real way.
And yeah. we've done training, me and Richard, helping new activists know how to canvass. And you know, and we always and we never give them a set script. Obviously, there are questions we want to get the answer to, like voter intention and things like that. But actually, I always advise them, just ask them what is there anything they need help with first when you talk to us. Don't make it about you, make it about them. And then, like I said, you don't want to have an automaton sort of response. Okay, this is what you want, X, Y, Z. Have a conversation. Find out what's bothering them in the community. Listen to them, and then you can bring it back to yourself and say, "Okay, this is what we've done regarding speeding or whatever else in your issue." But your books, I mean, this is very liberal Democrat, and I know this is you talk about the power of community activism and empowerment, and I take it from a very personal issue. And so I got involved in politics because of national issues originally. It was the Iraq War, 90 days with detention without trial, things like that in Britain, which were highly controversial. But I stayed in politics and have been elected 5 times now because of the community stuff. I love being able to help the community. And I think that, again, if you're just a hobbyist, as soon as the issue is off the front pages, you'll lose interest. But if you engage with the community and get embedded in the community and helping that community, then you can, like, I don't know, Richard, how long have you been elected now, Richard?
38 years.
38 years as an elected representative. So, and you don't stay there, because think of what politics has changed nationally in those 38 years, Richard, but it's your sense of community that keeps it. And your book makes that point, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I see this a lot from my students. You know, I think there is, you know, we're kind of at this moment of record high levels of loneliness, of disconnection. And I think not enough people know this story that, you know, if they think they feel connected to some national drama headlines, that's nothing compared to what it's like to be in a community organization where people take care of one another and where you could actually like change someone's life, you know. And so I've become a bit of an evangelical for this, because you can see that's the, in the stories. I mean, I think you see these people, many of whom did come to politics because they were mad about Trump or mad about an immigration issue or mad about whatever. And then they realize their job is actually to build a community and make it strong so that it can weigh in on political issues. And to do that political community building, you actually do the same thing that you would do if you were building a religious community or a civic community of any kind, which is that, you know, you take care of people. And so there's these amazing stories in the book of, you know, when there was a government shutdown and people were having trouble making ends meet, you know, these community organizations that were really formed to, like, because they hated Trump, all of a sudden they're like delivering diapers and gas cards to their neighbors. I think, you know, sometimes I talk to groups of like writers who are interested in writing, and, you know, I tell them, like, there's no better stories anywhere than what you'll get from a monthly meeting of a community organization, where you get to see people from different walks of life, people who are rich and poor, smart and not so smart, you know, have all sorts of interesting, there's characters, you know, there are characters. So if you're looking for characters, you know, don't look on cable news. You'll find better characters in the monthly meeting.
Yeah. And as a politician, I've never been held in elected national office, but I have been our leader nationally in local government. I still talk on health nationally. I've represented the UK on the World Body for Local Government. But all of that can only take place to me because I go out on the street just in front of my house and talk to people. So I've talked in the UN about Penny Lane and about problems I face, because actually the whole world is composed of neighborhoods and communities and streets and villages. And how do politicians remain grounded if they're not on the ground? Perhaps that was a rhetorical question.
Yeah, that's right. Right. And I think this is really is a problem for, you know, I think technology is not the only driver of political hobbyism, but you know, the move towards just a focus only on national celebrity kind of politics is just very damaging for politicians or anyone trying to build stronger community ties. I mean, you know, if you can get 30 people in a town in the United States who demand a meeting with the police superintendent or with the mayor, that almost never happens. You can get 1,000 people dispersed around the whole country to sign an online petition that's going to do nothing. And it's not as valuable as 30 people from the neighborhood saying, hey, we really care about this thing. Take us seriously. And so a lot of this is just shifting energy away from the national towards the local. And it's not because, you know, when I say that, oftentimes people who are really kind of kicking and screaming away from my argument will say, but all the important stuff is happening nationally. It's Trump. It's, you know, it's climate change. It's all that. And I think it's so hard sometimes to see that actually there's like a million local things that weigh in on those very same issues that they care about.
And it's people not understanding the connect. I mean, we could talk about the Brexit marches that were like, you know, a million people marching on London about the Britain leaving the EU. And I remember when the last ones came back, I said, okay, if every single one of them got active in their local politics, it would be a massive sea change in politics across this country. But of course, they didn't. A vast majority of them didn't. They all do the petitions. They will go on a march. They will, you know, wave a flag in their local town centre, but actually not try and change fundamentally the politics where they live. And a bit like what you were saying, politics generally in the UK is fairly weak. You know, you look at some of the local parties, and there isn't an awful lot of activity on any of the politics from any of the parties. And so you get a group of 6 to 12 people, you can make a massive difference locally and change election results across a whole swathe of an area, but they've got to want to do it. And you talk about hollow organizations, and it really rings true with lots of Lib Dem groups within the UK, where you say, look, I have been the chairman of the whatever Liberal Democrats for 20 years. Okay, but what have you done with that, what you call a comical amount of power? What change have you brought? And it's key, though. You've got to want to have change and fight for it. It's not just being.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think I really think of that in the context of the fights within, say, the Democratic Party here between the older generation, the younger generation, where, you know, the reason why all of these young voters in America have been voting for Bernie Sanders is they don't see it the way the older voters, like, just get Trump out of there. Just give me someone who's plain and boring and not Trump. And the younger voters say, like, that's not good enough because, like, we can't afford to live anywhere. And, you know, the climate is this. And, you know, so and the way to resolve that is through local organizing that does both of those things, that, like, has a strong long-term base of people who have been and can be leaders and can be mentors, and also has the energy of younger people who want to do stuff. When I see community, I sometimes talk to community organizations that have a board where everyone on the board is in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. And they're wondering, like, how do we get more young people involved? And like, well, here's number one, put a high school student on your board. You know, don't have a community organization that doesn't put young people are not going to be pawns for you. But if you put them in leadership positions and you mentor them, then they will be willing to buy in because you've bought into them. I think, you know, it's simple stuff like that that can make a big difference.
Yeah, but it's also the way that we respond. So I may look very old to you, but I was 14 when I joined the party, and I've been here for 53 years. But I always remember the way I was treated when I was a 14-year-old, which was partly disdain and partly go and deliver these leaflets, Sonny. And so if we listen to young people, there's no point in having someone on the board if you're going to patronise them. So you've got to say, you have a different set of experiences than I do. You've got different ideas. Do we have common principles? But you run with your bit of it, and I'll run with my bit of it, because we need to get the old buggers like me to vote for us as well as the young ones. And of course, John Potter is somewhat in the middle.
The squeezed middle. Thank you, yeah. but I suppose it's been an absolutely fantastic conversation. And I'll remind, just before I ask you a final question, that remember this book is available in Britain on a hardback, paperback and audio CD now. So do make sure you go. I've really enjoyed it, but we can't let you go without asking about American politics, actually, in terms of what's happening. I mean, because almost American politics is the hobbyist dream in the UK. And I think about, you know, when Brett Kavanaugh became the Supreme Court Justice.
Brexit was fun for us too, by the way. We love Brexit.
it's very interesting because I think Brits that only care about sensational politics look at American politics. I mean, I was just thinking, could any Brit name a single Supreme Court Justice in Britain? Probably not. They probably don't even know that we have 12 of them. But so I've got to ask you an impression about what's the current state? I mean, we're hearing that it looks like Biden is well ahead in the polls. Trump's dealing with coronavirus so badly, but I've always got a caution in me that I thought that about Hillary Clinton as well. But what's your sense on the ground?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't know what's happened. I think, you know, incumbent presidents, when they run for re-election, usually win. Something like mm-hmm. 2/3 of time in history, they win. When they don't win, it's in situations like this where the economy is tanked. There's all sorts of things that have gone wrong where you really can put the blame on the president for failing. But, you know, on average, the president is re-elected. I think it is a good sign on the Democratic side that they put someone up to challenge him who is as close to an incumbent president as you can basically get. Obviously, there's all sorts of contingencies. There's, you know, the age of the candidates. There's things like that we don't know. And a lot of it stuff that's happening right now is, you know, I think that our federalist system has been both a blessing and a curse in the Trump era. In Massachusetts here where I live, we're at a lull in coronavirus, and that's because thankfully we have competent leadership here and Donald Trump's not in charge of most of the day-to-day management of coronavirus. That's true for elections as well. And in general, we have state by state, you know, very competent election officials who are trying to do a good job, but they all are trying to scramble to make new rules on balloting and all that. And that part is really tricky. You know, we're counting on local and state election officials in every municipality in the country to do a good job here. And we know there's plenty of instances where they haven't done a good job in the past. And so there's a lot of nervousness, I think appropriately, around that. You know, that's where things are. I think I don't know. If I were to make a bet about it, I would probably go with the polls right now, but not by much. I wouldn't make a very big bet on it.
No.
I find it fascinating. About 3 years ago, it was after Trump got elected, and there was something like the following December, a governor's election or a special Senate election. And there were 50 of us in a room in Uganda. And we all knew that there was this election taking place that otherwise we would have had no clear on. And I get the Washington Post every morning. And I mean, it's reassuring for me because our politics isn't very good at the moment with people like Donald Trump. But I look at the Washington Post thing, bloody hell, at least I'm not in America at the moment. And I'm just amazed that you can elect someone who grabs pussy, who thinks you can, you know, inject bleach. And that anyone, he makes Boris Johnson look good.
I was going to say we've got no right to preach when we have Boris Johnson in charge of Britain.
It's a relative thing, but I just really. So I find the Washington Post very entertaining in the morning, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a there's a whole other podcast we can talk about why why American politics is what it is. But you know, I think there is some things that are. Not going to be resolvable in terms of people on different sides of the issue, and you know, those who whoever gets more votes is going to win. But I think in the past, actually, Democrats have not done a very good job operating within the rules of the system that they have, which is if we have an electoral college system, if we have a system where states matter a lot, you can't just make people happy in the cities. You can't run elections and run candidates who are going to be very exciting to Cambridge, Massachusetts. And that's going to mean that your everything from the things that you're proposing in policy to the candidates who you run, they're not going to be for the benefit of Cambridge, Massachusetts. If you want to win. And I think in a lot of cases, and I think actually you probably do see this in Britain too, a lot of people would rather stick to their principles than win anything. And I think there's a real risk of that, and Donald Trump is such a risk.
Yeah, I think
what
we
you
saw
taught me to give John an intro into the finale is that actually there are differences between us, but a lot of what you've said has struck such a chord with me about community level engagement, taking things up, the difference between people who want to talk and the people who want to do. So perhaps the differences in any democracy are minimal compared to any democracy against a non-democracy like China. So I've been fascinated by what you've taught me today about the similarities between our systems, not the differences.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. I still have never been to the UK, but I hope one day I can make it over there.
And well, the Northwest is the place to go.
Penny Lane, never mind Preston. Take you to Penny Lane, provided you can sing the song.
No, I just really want to thank you so much for it. I mean, everything, even the last point you just made, people could exactly attribute that in British politics to what happened with Corbyn in Labour. He seemed to be almost dogmatic in his views, and people loved him within his inner circle, but the electorate on a general just didn't take to it at all. And so we've got to be careful we don't just look inside our own little bubbles and remember the community that puts us there. But I just want to say thank you so much, Professor Hirsch. If you want to follow Professor Hirsch, he is on Twitter at Eaton Hirsch. Like I say, do get his book. I really enjoyed this book. I think it's excellent. And even though it is about American politics, so many of the structures are identical to British politics in terms of what we can do right, what we can learn, etc. So thank you so much, Richard. And thank you for Richard, as always, for being beside me on the podcast. Do stay in touch with everything to do with the podcast at LibDemPod on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Do look after yourself, and we'll have another episode very soon.
Thanks so much for having me. Take care.
A pleasure.